At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast, sponsored by The Nation magazine. This week, we're going to deal with a form of monster that I think many people encounter in their life. You almost have to encounter them if you want to own a motor vehicle in the United States, which is like car dealers. And it's a kind of funny profession, because if you look at like sort of polling and but even just popular culture, like the sort of the car dealer, it has a very bad reputation. It's the kind of notoriously sleazy operative. I often think of the great Coen Brothers movie Fargo, where the guy who tries to fake a kidnapping of his wife is a car dealer and has all the kind of negative traits that one associates with car dealership, of kind of like weaselly deception and trying to fool his customers by putting in a lot of unnecessary expenses. But I mean, beyond this kind of like joking view of car dealers, though, they kind of are a really important part of the economy, and also like perhaps the future, like in terms of issues of the environment. You know, one of the paths to decarbonization is through electrical vehicles. And there's a real question as to where car dealers fit into that vision. So I was thought about a lot of this because I read this excellent piece by Alex Salmon, a frequent guest on this program, who in Slate, where he went to a national conference for car dealers. And we'll talk about that. And I think one of the upshots of his piece is about the sort of reactionary political role that car dealers play in American society and how that could have an impact on environmental policy. So Alex, once again, welcome to the program.
Hey, yeah, glad to be here as ever.
So let's talk about this conference. Just that you kind of went under, like, I wouldn't say false pretenses, but you kind of had to go a little bit under the cover because they didn't want to give you a press pass, right?
Yeah, I really tried to do it above board too. I emailed them like many months in advance saying that I wanted to cover the conference. I got in touch with the press officer and they sort of strung me along for a while. Then they said that they'd run out of press passes, which was just a totally implausible explanation, given that this is a gigantic conference, you know, held at a convention center. And then I said, all right, you know, if you know, I can't get a press pass, then I'll just buy a pass. And I asked them which one I should buy. At that point, they stopped responding to me. So I bought a very expensive pass. I got the classic upsell in a lot of ways. I bought the very expensive pass. And then I found out that actually that wouldn't even get me into the opening night party, which was a big part of what I wanted to see. So I had to buy a second entry pass on top of that. So it ended up being a not insignificant outlay. And yeah, so I got the dealer's badge and I got in there and yeah, it just took a little doing.
Now, I should mention that it wasn't totally underhanded, because I believe Slate has some sort of car dealer connection. And so you were like a legitimate part of the car dealer family.
Yeah, but that's right. Yeah, the holding company that owns Slate, also in their more profit-making side of the operation, has purchased a bunch of car dealers. And those car dealers are actually also dues-paying members of this group, this lobbying group, the National Automotive Dealers Association. So I reached out to them and they declined to be interviewed. But we do have, yeah, that was a funny disclosure to have to make. We do have some weird and sort of secondary financial investment in this operation, which I think, you know, yeah.
Okay, so let's just describe the mood of the conference that you saw. This is like a huge conference. Where was it held again?
It was in Dallas.
No, it's okay. And so I'm imagining, like, you know, like, you know, the high-end hotel, you know, lots of luxury. And this is a class of people. They're pretty well-to-do, right? Like, where do car dealers fit into the American economy?
They're right. So I think there are a class of people that are sort of deceptively well off. There was a really great analysis of like the American super rich of the top 0.1% of American earners that was done out of UC Berkeley, I believe, by a handful of academics. And car dealers is one of the top five most common professions for the top 0.1% of American earners. So we're talking about really substantial money. And there's another sort of Census Bureau data breakdown that said that car dealers, gas station owners, and building contractors make up the majority of the 140,000 Americans who make about $1.6 million a year or more. So, like, you know, this is a really, really remunerative operation. These people are very, very rich. I think by any classification, you would have to say that they're part of the very, very top stratum of wealth in the United States. So,
not only in terms of the money they make, but how many of them there are out there, right? Like, it's not right. Like, you know, like, I would imagine hedge fund managers make more money, but there's a lot fewer of them. And right. Whereas the car dealers, like, in every state, and they're the wealthy part of the each, like, sort of local economy. They're the sort of gentry of the, you know, American hinterland, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I want to emphasize this because I think it goes to sort of like longstanding arguments that people have had about, you know, like sort of Trumpism and the Republican Party. Is it becoming more working class? Is it, you know, like there's a lot of appeal to the, you know, certainly non-college whites who have moved in that direction. And I think non-college educated people more broadly have been attracted to the Republican Party and certainly Trumpism in for a variety of reasons. But I think that has to be set aside against the fact that the real sort of backbone and structure of the Republican Party is this kind of, you know, like local gentry in the sort of heartland of America, these kind of like car dealers who are like, usually, you know, among the wealthiest people in their communities, are the backbone of like sort of country club life and of the Republican Party. And, you know, it seems to me like ideologically have a lot of affinity for Trumpism, like that sort of like, you know, family business model and that sort of version of capitalism. And then they might be more critical of sort of, you know, the sort of elite corporate capital of like, you know, New York City or whatever. But within, you know, their ecosystem, they are the top, right?
Absolutely. Right. And it's like, right, you could see it, you could look at this demographic, you could squint hard at this sort of demographic on paper and say, well, there's something interesting here. This is like, the class profile is like non-college educated whites. It really squares exactly with what we would say is sort of core Trumpism, but exactly, they're incredibly well off. These are businesses, these are family businesses, quote unquote, that are they're passed through generationally, but it's not like they're small businesses, they're huge businesses. And actually a lot of the Trump tax cuts were written exactly to advantage these kind of businesses. So these huge corporate entities that have been around for generations that are super profitable and allow them to be handed from one generation to the next of, you know, one non-college educated generation to the next with minimal tax burden. And then on top of that, you add the sort of like sleazy, oleaginous businessman profile that you know, think of when you think of car dealers. And that also squares with Trump exactly. It's like the family business, you have every family member on the employ, and then the sort of, you know, the shady business dealings and the
patriarch who's kind of a bit of a, you know, godfather figure, looks after everyone, but is, you know, prizes loyalty above all. And, you know, like, I mean, it does, and has a like a value sort of social presentation, values like, you know, like looking the part of the successful businessman. I mean, I mean, Trump's coming out of sort of like real estate, but he does sort of fit the model of the car dealer.
Definitely.
So and like politically, like that's exactly where they align, right? Like who do these car dealers give their money to?
Just devout conservatives. I think the sort of like broad sweep analysis of their political givings has car dealers donating to Republicans at about 6-1. I think you look in recent years, actually, it kind of skews even more conservative than that. And there are years where there's more giving to Democrats because Democrats are in control, but you're looking at an incredibly reliable, incredibly conservative affinity group. And that's on all levels of government, right? That's like local, state, national, that's lobbying, that's political action committees, that's like they have the apparatus is huge and it's incredibly advanced and incredibly organized, and it's overwhelmingly Republicans. I mean, and not just Republicans, it's overwhelmingly conservative Republicans, especially those who are willing to take up the mantle of this business interest. So it's one party, certainly.
Yeah, one party, and very politically organized for very good reasons, which is that their whole economic model depends on them getting very specific kind of like carve outs and protections from the state, from like the state at all levels, like, you know, local governments to the federal government, the all sorts of like sort of tax protections, but also even like legal protections. And so, I mean, in your piece, you go into some of the history of this. So, but and it might be worth just covering this a little bit, like when did these car dealers come together and what were they able to achieve through political organizing?
Yeah. So yeah, the bevy of protections is almost like too long to list. It's incredible. And I think some of them are so ridiculous that you know, you laugh when you see them. You almost can't believe that they're real. But they really it started, so car dealers as a function started basically at the beginning of the 20th century. And very quickly, they were useful because car manufacturers didn't want to have to build out a national sales network. So you could, you know, let this third-party group do the selling. But then car dealers very quickly found out that, like, if a car manufacturer wanted to open like a Ford dealership on the same block as the Ford dealer, they could undersell the car dealer and that would put them out of business. So from the very beginning, they were really active about lobbying, about getting legal protections. And I think the first official act of the NADA as an organization was in the run-up to World War One. I think actually in 1917, so already underway. There was a lot of concern that car manufacturing facilities would be converted for wartime production, and car manufacturers, you know, probably fine with that. You're getting paid by the federal government. You're going to make good money. Wartime economy is not bad for, you know, for that set, but for car dealers, it's horrible because you can't sell tanks and artillery and stuff to, you know, people in the hinterland or the American West or whatever. And so they go to Congress, these car dealers, and basically start lobbying. And they're able to get cars reclassified as a non-luxury good, which makes them ineligible for wartime production conversion. And they get, I think, a 40% tax cut of the luxury tax, which was then being implemented on car sales as a pretty nascent and not widespread technology at that point. And from then, it's basically off to the races. It's just, you know, it's one thing after the next that all through the 30s and 40s, they're winning protections that say, you know, car manufacturers are prohibited by law from selling cars at all. They're prohibited from service. They're prohibited from, you know, opening up, you know, other car dealers are prohibited by law from opening up a competing store anywhere within a certain radius. It, you know, it's on and on and on and on.
Yeah. No. And they do receive a lot of protection, and that's actually the basis of their business model, in the sense that if they, you know, like if the government policy were designed to like maximize competition and, you know, serve the consumer to get the lowest possible prices for cars, you know, you wouldn't have this model, right? Although you wouldn't create this system of middlemen, you know, who, you know, initially came in for a particular reason, which is that, you know, like when Henry Ford and these other companies were starting up, you know, they had a lot of capital outlay and they couldn't invest in dealerships. But, you know, like after a while, that stopped being the point. But this is like an appendix that can not only continue to thrive, but like really carved up most of it, the money that's coming in from this. And so like, just if you're a car dealer, like how are you making money? Like, is it just from the sale of the car or where else is it from?
Yeah, it's most of the money comes from parts and service. And which is really interesting. I think that obviously, you know, if you've purchased a car, you know, the experience of, you know, being quoted a price and then getting haggled and then the price is actually opaque and, you know, they can't do it for this number. And, you know, there are always these, you know, incredible add-ons where they have to massage your tires and put some, you know, invisible coat of something that's going to cost thousands of dollars. But on top of all that, the majority of the money comes from parts and service. And car dealers, one of their many, many legal protections is that many of them are you know, protected by law and being the only place that can, or the only places that can do warranty service for cars. And so they make a ton of money basically upselling both the car manufacturers themselves and car owners on parts, on service, on warranty service, on extended warranties. It's a huge moneymaker. And so basically, you know, they're effectively robbing you blind in these ancillary ways, but to a spectacular degree, because the top 10 dealership groups in the U.S. have annual revenues that exceed any individual car maker. I mean, you know, we're not talking about nickels and dimes here. We're talking about massive revenues. So that's the model. And that model, as I think we'll probably get into, is now a little bit under threat for a variety of reasons.
Yeah, no. I think that's where we'll get to. Also, I want to like talk just before we get there, because I think it's maybe get a little bit of color into this. So how was the mood at this like conference? Because on the one hand, like car dealers, you know, should be like really happy. Like they've had like, you know, coming out of COVID, you know, there were shortages but that drove up prices, and there are people who had deferred buying a car, and now there's like a great demand. And so they've actually had like a really good time lately. Like they've been making record profits, but what was the mood like at this event?
Yeah, a really fascinating combination of things, because, right, as you say, the last 2 years have been the best 2 years ever for this industry. There was one report that said profits were up 180% over 2019. So the COVID era has been incredibly favorable to them. So, you know, and as you'd expect, the celebration aspect of this meeting was incredibly decadent, excessive, kind of almost beyond description, where you have, it was like every 8 feet there were open bars. There were, you know, you had their giant tubs full of ice and beer. And you had, I mean, in the first night alone, there were like three or four live musical acts playing.
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All at the same time in various parts of this venue. And then there were three or four DJs. And then there was Brad Paisley. And then there was a blackjack table and a saloon. And, you know, they had dancers and stilt walkers. I mean, you know, it was like a parade, effectively, a private parade with, you know, sort of expensive blue chip musical talent on top of it. And that kind of continued through the whole weekend. It was just, you know, nonstop drinking, the private parties of incredible decadence. And so all that on one hand, and then on the other hand, the sort of speakers and the programming and the sort of daytime stuff was also really stark. And you know, there was this really palpable concern about where things were headed, the sort of proclamations of impending doom, and a lot of worry, a lot of anxiety about what the future holds.
Yeah. No, I mean, you're, and I'm going to encourage, I'll link to your piece that I would really strongly encourage listeners to read, because it does describe this very decadent atmosphere. And to me, it does sort of call to mind, you know, some of what one reads in sort of court historians of France before the revolution, you know, like après moi, le déluge, you know, like after us, you know, like it's all going to be torn away, and we got to, you know, like let the good times roll now, because we're going to be in deep trouble. So what is this anxiety, you know, amid this, you know, decadence, enjoying being on the top, you know, 1% of the 1%, what is this unease that was also at this event?
Yeah, so it's kind of two-pronged, but all of it centers on electric cars. And the two major concerns of electric cars, one is that the electric car startups like Tesla, Lucid, Rivian, have basically shunned the dealership model, and they've you know, these groups have learned the thing that, you know, Ford and GM and these legacy car manufacturers know, which is that it's actually cheaper and better for them to just sell directly to consumer. They don't have to deal with this middleman. They don't have to worry about some unaffiliated group, you know, tarnishing their reputation, screwing up the sale, you know, ripping off the consumer, and it's more profitable. So you have these new car companies, these new EV companies in particular, have basically refused to play by the dealership model. And the direct to consumer sales thing is, you know, it is working. It's making inroads. The CEO of Ford at an investor conference last year basically said, like, let's get rid of these dealers. Let's do this direct to consumer thing, put it all online. And then was forced, of course, to walk it back because of the power of this lobby. But that's the one encroaching problem, is that there is an obvious workaround here that is technologically viable and sort of on offer in a number of places in the country. And the other concern is that because electric cars are actually at a very basic level, a better product, they need less upkeep, they need less repair, they have fewer parts. That means the warranty and service dollar is disappearing, because you don't need to be changing the oil all the time. You don't need to be fixing the transmission and everything else in the same way. And so that sort of part of the business is rapidly going away. And that's true for EVs that are sold direct to consumer, and for EVs that are sold by dealers. And so they don't want to put you in an electric car that's going to make them, you know, 25% as much money on service. And yet here we go on the EV revolution. This is a core part of the climate strategy of the Biden administration, and it's happening. So those two threats, very acute, very concerning for this group.
Yeah. And to be clear, like the threat is that this is a better product for consumers, and that there are alternative ways to sell it that are actually better for consumers. And, you know, one can sort of look at the car dealers as a kind of classic kind of like rent seeker people, you know, who have managed to carve out a profitable niche through a regulatory regime that forces people to, like, you know, use their service, but that is not, like, you know, like economically rational at all. And this might be, I mean, it's interesting that, like, you know, that sort of critique of rent seeking, you know, has become very popular coming out of, you know, neoclassical economics and this sort of neoliberal revolution. But, like, I've rarely, if ever, seen it applied to car dealers. Like, it's usually applied to, like, you know, going after unions and going after, you know, like, maybe that, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. Like,
Right. It's like, I mean, you remember under the Obama years, they were saying that, like people who cut hair, you know, the cartel of the certified haircut industry is like something that needs to be broken because it's excessively rent seeking. It's like, this is probably the biggest example of this. I mean, this is a group that's incredibly, incredibly rich and influential, and they're all over the country. And that's one of the things that makes them so formidable as a political entity, is that, like, you know, they have these networks and they sponsor these little league teams and they buy local ad space in the paper and they're extractive in an incredible way. And yet you don't really see the sort of fulsome critique of this that you saw of you know,
barbers
and beauticians and stuff. And I think it's because there's genuine fear about what they can, you know, do to you politically, which has been proven over and over again. You know, if they set their sights on a political outcome, they'll get it. And that's why, you know, the event that I went to, the NADA show, as they call it, like, The number of, like, presidential hopefuls who've come to this event dating back to the 60s is astounding. The number of presidents who just finished terms, it's like the Bushes, the Clintons, LBJ, Reagan, like the list of attendees is spectacular. That's because they just amassed incredible political power.
Yeah. Now, maybe a little bit speculative here, but, like, do you think that they will be able to, like, kind of thwart or slow down or, you know, put substantial roadblocks in the sort of electric car revolution that's coming? I've noticed that, like, you know, like, electric cars seem to be taking off more in China than they do in the United States. And it seems like maybe, like, you know, like a country that doesn't have this oligarchical group with a sort of stranglehold on politics has some advantages, like, just on that one particular issue.
Right. I think it's a really good point and a really great comparison to make. I think that, like, There are a group of sort of, like, center left, what we'd say, like, quasi neoliberal, you know, neoliberal supportive of the Biden IRA climate strategy, but sort of still, you know, market enthusiasts who would say, like, oh, these car dealers are going to lose, they're going to get crushed, this technology is better, the market prefers it. We also made all these incentives to make sure the market, you know, prefers it. And I just don't think you can say that. I don't think you can say like, oh, it's going to sort itself out. These guys are going to get crushed. If that were the case, they would have gotten crushed a long time ago. And I think that, like, you know, the comparison to China is really apt. There was a survey that was done by the Sierra Club a couple of weeks ago, actually, that found that 2/3 of car dealerships had no electric vehicles on offer. And half of those said that they would not be offering electric vehicles under any circumstances. And so, you know, like, they're doing it. The question is it going to just slow down the process, you know, such that it'll happen eventually? Will they be able to thwart it entirely? They might. I think it's just something you have to really take seriously. And we've already seen that, like, there is evidence of this playing a role. This is a important choke point in this strategy. And I think you would be foolish not to take it seriously. I think we've already seen signs of it.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I mean, I think it gets to sort of like larger issues of problems that the United States will have in sort of, you know, an adaptation mitigation strategy towards climate is just that in America, there's so many veto points and there's so many powerful interest groups that can, like, you know, prevent things, you know, like building denser cities, you know, and moving towards electric vehicles. I mean, I think this is like a kind of, you know, something people need to be thinking about. Now, there's an argument you made against your piece, and I wanted to mention it. I noticed that Matt Stoller, who is a director of research at the American Economics Liberty Project, made some objections to your piece, and I wanted to raise them. Do you want to, like, say what he had issues with?
Yeah, I think the crux of Matt's sort of objection or contention is that, like, this is mostly an aesthetic objection as opposed to a substantive one, that, like, people don't like car dealers, or that, you know, my sort of gloss on this was excessively negative because car dealers are not Ivy League educated, you know, sort of like meritocratic elites. They're elites of a different persuasion. They sort of like engage in a different level of, I guess, like consumerism of sort of elite projection or whatever. And this is basically an aesthetic revulsion as opposed to an economic one. And that actually this institution is useful because it keeps big car companies from monopolizing the sales product, or monopolizing, I guess, this market, which is, you know, massive and incredibly important in the United States, where we don't really have a functional public transit, and therefore that, you know, the car dealers are actually sort of like misunderstood and should be a thriving and important class to in a sort of non-monopolized economy.
Yeah. And I should mention that Stoller, you know, who's a kind of influential voice in a variety of policy debates, is coming out of the kind of sort of, you know, anti-monopoly populism that really extols sort of like the mom and pop model, the sort of, you know, and sees the role of the state as to try to, like, you know, disperse capital as broadly across the society as well. And from that point of view, like, you know, like a sort of electric car revolution that leads to, you know, Ford, GM, Tesla selling their own cars means a more sort of concentrated monopoly form. I mean, when one sees this in, like, you know, many sort of debates, you know, like in sort of banking sector, is the goal to break up the banks, or is it, you know, like you can have, you know, big centralized banks, you just have to regulate them more. And in some ways it's kind of, I think for a certain more socialistic wing of the left, like, you know, like bigness per se is not a problem, because if you have like big corporations, they're actually like easier to unionize, they're easier to regulate, they're easier to kind of, you know, get on board with democratic policies. So yeah, I mean, where do you think this sort of shakes down? Like, do you in terms of this, I feel like this is a genuine dispute on the left.
Yeah, it's interesting. I obviously have a lot of thoughts about this. One is that I think that sort of misapprehends the nature of car dealers in their current form, which is, you know, in the 30s, they made a real concerted effort to project themselves as like mom and pop, small businesses, like coming out of the progressive era, where these sorts of values were really at the height of the American business model. And they already weren't that. They already were really, you know, were largely monopolized themselves. Very large business entities that were owned by, you know, families and then passed on and continued to grow and grow. And I think that at a basic level, I think you'd have to sort of accept that that's the case, because it most certainly is. And then I think that on a political level, you know, even if you were to say, okay, in my sort of idealized economy, we would have groups like this that prevent, you know, sort of just a handful of large companies lapping up an entire sector. That would all be one thing, but I think you have to look at the sector as it actually is, which is that it's a, you know, incredibly politically active, as we've been talking about, an incredibly politically active conservative organization that opposes all the other things that someone who, you know, would wants a, you know, an anti-monopolized economy to exist, they oppose all of those things. And so it's not just a sort of neutral existence that they lead. It's a, an incredibly politically malevolent one if you're someone who cares about these things you care about broadly, and if you're on the left in general about any of this stuff. And so I think that, you know, the third thing I would say is that also they're incredibly profoundly and universally disliked. I mean, if you're going to make a mass politics, this is like one of the best places you could start, you know, beyond like saying you don't like the DMV. It's like, this group is one of the most reviled and loathed in anywhere in American society, and for good reason. And so if you're trying to put together a sort of mass political project, I don't think you start by saying car dealers are in and other stuff is out. I think if you're going to draw a line, it's pretty hard to see any line that doesn't have car dealers on the other side of it. So that's kind of my feeling on some of this.
No, I think that's right. And I think in your piece as well, like, I think one of the points that you make is the kind of like rent seeking aspect of this. Like, it's not like, this is like not like mom and pop, you know, selling to the local neighborhood. This is mom and pop, you know, using state and federal governments to, like, you know, amass great wealth, jack up prices, and then pass on their money to their squalid children. So I just don't see, like, you know, like you know, the mom and pop thing to me, like, is not very convincing, considering, you know, who mom and pop actually are. And how they actually make their money. Like, it's but it does. I mean, I think Stoller's critique does show the sort of ideological success that they've had, like not just like political success, but they have, like, you know, like taken this, like, you know, I would say absurd and fictional ma and pop model, and, like, you know, like convinced people who should know better that this is what reality is.
Totally. I mean, there's so many sort of like fantastical elements to this. And I think that, you know, even the fact, like, the, you know, that the acronym is NADA, and it's like this, you know, it's nothing, but it's this incredibly forceful political operation that the NADA pack and the NADA show, like, it feels like it's like something straight out of Pynchon. It's like the whole thing is, you know, it's so beyond fantastical in some ways. And that's a big part of that projection, right? It's like, it's, they're saying that they're this small little, you know, nothing. And in fact, they are this incredibly organized, massive apparatus industry. And yeah, I think that tells you a lot, actually, a lot of how Republican politics works when it's working. So
yeah, that's right. That's right. I forgot that this organization is called NADA. And maybe that's a note to kind of end on. I will quote from Ernest Hemingway's great story, A Clean, Well-Lighted Place. Our NADA, who art in NADA, NADA be thy name, thy kingdom NADA, thy will be NADA, in NADA as it is in NADA. Is the use of the Spanish word for nothingness mixed in with the Lord's Prayer. And this is perhaps the demonic prayer that one should offer this really wretched organization. So I want to thank you, Alex, for being on. It was a very productive conversation.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. That was great.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.